Thank you. Thanks, everybody. Well, I can't remember exactly the first time I communicated with Carl Truman, but my memory tells me that it was almost a decade ago when his local public school in suburban Philadelphia, where Carl lived at the time, was having some kind of controversy over transgenders in public school bathrooms, something like that. Carl was trying to rally the community to mount a defense against this sort of thing happening. And we were emailing back and forth about it. I recall that Carl failed. Few, if any, parents wanted to stand against this stuff. Neither did area pastors. Back then, this was totally shocking to me that parents and pastors wouldn't stand up against it. Not even parents, not even pastors. Unbelievable. Back then. Now this is totally normal. One pastor stood up, though, Carl Truman. He was brave and he was faithful. Over the years, I grew to admire Carl's insight into theological and moral and cultural matters, and I admired his great gift for writing. He has a way of seeing deeply into things, and through his plain, lucid prose, helping the rest of us who can't see as well to see what he does. At some point, I suggested to Carl that he should write a book explaining the work of the great 20th century cultural critic Philip Reeve to dummies like me. I don't know if you've ever tried to read Philip Reeve. He's brilliant, but he's very, very hard to understand. He writes in a very jargony way. Well, to my shock and delight, Carl did write that book, but actually he made it far broader than just Philip Reeve. This book, called The Rise and Triumph of the Modern Self, came out last year, I think it was, and it became a bestseller. This is very well deserved because Carl Truman's book is without a doubt one of the most important Christian books published in this century. And if you don't have a copy of it, rush back as soon as he finishes talking to buy what they have left at 8 Day Books. It's just that good. It is a superlative gift to the universal church because it helps us all to see once again into the depths of our civilizational crisis. We cannot begin to mount an effective resistance if we don't even understand the nature of the problem. Well, if the churches of the English-speaking world manage to stand firmly and prophetically against the disorder of our age, Carl Truman's great book will be a cornerstone of our victory. Now, that's quite an accomplishment, and Carl is still fairly young, so who knows what's coming next? So it's a real honor to introduce Carl Truman tonight, and not only with gratitude for his prophetic work, but also because he's married to Catriona, who's the baker of the world's very best shortbread. If you've ever tasted this shortbread, no wonder Carl writes so beautifully and so powerfully, because look at how well-nourished he is by his wife. Ladies and gentlemen, I give you Catriona's husband, Carl Truman.
Rod is the greatest publicist I've ever had. In fact, he's the only publicist I've ever had. So I'd quite forgotten that was the first time we'd had contact. And it was not the, probably not the last time, I guess, that I've been subjected to cultural defeat in something I've done. But I'm an Englishman. Defeat is inevitable. But I will meet you on the field of battle, nonetheless. I want to talk this evening about the two self-denials, Christian and modern. The conflict between Christianity and the values of our contemporary culture can be understood in a number of ways. There is the obvious moral conflict between biblical sexual morality and that of our permissive and pornified age. There is the religious conflict between a faith predicated on a belief in divine revelation and a world that denies the existence of anything transcendent or immaterial. And there is the struggle between those who think of truth in terms of that which is objectively real and those who think of it in utilitarian terms. On each point, Christian orthodoxy finds itself in direct confrontation with this present age. And yet I want to suggest in this lecture that there is a further and more basic point of conflict between the two, which serves as a backdrop to these particular points of contention, and which needs to be grasped in order to understand the nature of the problems which the church faces in the future. It is the issue of the nature and status of self-denial. By the way, I refer to Christian orthodoxy there. I've met a number of orthodox Christians here. I too am an orthodox Christian, but an orthodox Presbyterian. And I will be quoting Protestant sources in my paper. Self-denial in the modern world. Numerous thinkers have characterized the present age as one where personal satisfaction, understood as personal psychological contentment or well-being, is the central concern. Philip Reeve dubbed this the therapeutic society. From the criticisms of Hans Bosma, I'm shifting my language slightly, moving towards Leszek Kolakowski's preferred term for the therapeutic society, and that is the analgesic society. Both are characterized by an increasing intolerance of suffering on the grounds that suffering can fulfill no useful positive function. As Kolakowski expressed it, and I quote, "Among the outstandingly distinguishable aspects of our civilization is a belief, practiced rather than expressed, that security from suffering is worth any price, and specifically that those goods whose values it is impossible to measure, but which are unavailable without pain, are the inventions of maniacs or a residual superstition," end quote. In short, pain, that which has, among other things, generally been a necessary concomitant of personal growth, and which marks the most important of human phenomena, love as a matter of self-giving to another, is intolerable in such a society. From enhancing self-development, it actually harms that development by inhibiting it. In a similar vein, Reef also commented that the rise of this type of society would be marked by the decline of two institutions and the rise to prominence of two others. Those declining would be the church and the nation. Those ascending would be the hospital and the theater. And he wrote that before COVID. The reasons would be simple. Church and nation demand a sacrifice of the individual for something greater. Hospital and theater provide the palliatives that are necessary to keep the individual feeling good in a world that is somewhat less than perfect. In other words, society's institutional hierarchy would reconfigure based upon society's priorities, and those priorities would increasingly focus on the comfort of the individual. Now, to Reef's list of declining and rising institutions, I might add two more. On the decline side, I would list the family. And on the ascendant, I would list social media. The same rationale is in play with the family as with church and nation. It is an institution which demands a sacrifice of the individual for something greater. As to social media, all the evidence suggests that far from making people feel better, it generally has the opposite effect, feeding anxieties and insecurities. But it does enable one further aspect of the modern world that is important: the need to make life a public performance in order to be truly authentic. I often say to the students in class that we can all be Oscar Wilde today. Sadly, none of us have his talent, but we can all be Oscar Wilde today. One of only three people, I think, who should ever have been allowed a Twitter account, by the way. The other two being Martin Luther and Friedrich Nietzsche. Anyway, there are many reasons for this dramatic shift in society's priorities, encompassing both an intellectual genealogy and the story of how the institutions of family, church, and nation have been destabilized, both by internal corruption and by external cultural pressure. The internal corruptions of these institutions are relatively easy to delineate. For example, cheap and easy divorce has meant that the tensions and difficulties that have always marked marriages and family life are now easy to escape. It would be impossible to write Anna Karenina today, of course, because she would simply divorce her husband and run off with Vronsky. Churches have been racked for decades with scandals involving leaders using their positions to abuse the vulnerable and to fleece the flock. And what nation on earth is there whose reality lives up to the myths that sustain the acts of corporate imagination necessary to sustain its existence? Of course, these institutions have always been corrupt at some level. What is different today is the means by which that corruption is displayed for all to see, and how it is parlayed into an influential cultural narrative or narratives that serves to eviscerate them of any credibility. Social media has demolished the possibility of private space and made all news into local news. Hence, American police actions in Minneapolis can provoke protests in England and Australia. Always puzzled at the same time as you had the democratic protests and crackdowns in Hong Kong, which was a British colony up until 1997. I remember sitting as a married man, it was in my adulthood, watching Hong Kong handed over to the Chinese authorities in 1997. Nobody protested on the streets of England, as far as I could see, about Hong Kong, and yet Minneapolis gripped the imagination. And the hypocrisy of the church is on constant display in the living rooms of houses across the world through news reports of scandals, and the foibles of the family can be made the plot line of countless movies and sitcoms. Yet it is not simply the capacity to reach a wider audience with such narratives that marks our day off from the past. It is also the appetite of the public to see such things. The scandals of the priesthood, the breakdown of the family, the collapse of narratives of patriotism are not on the whole greeted with sadness and lamentation, and they are certainly not presented in such a manner. Rather, they are proposed more in the term of, we told you so. Look at how you were duped into thinking these things were goods, when all along they have been tools of oppression, abuse, and lies. And they are received in like spirit. And that indicates that there is something within our culture that facilitates precisely such a reception. What is it? Well, it is that, I think, which Reif and Kolakowski identified. For Reif, it is the therapeutic ideal. For Kolakowski, the culture of analgesics. And for both men, it is marked by a remarkable intolerance towards any kind of suffering or self-denial. The myths that guide the modern self are those that see no place for these things, and therefore they see no place for those institutions that might require them. We might say that family, church, and nation are thus implausible because they run counter to the picture of life which grips the imagination, indeed which forms the deepest intuitions of society as a whole. The philosophy of the modern self. The philosophy of the modern self is summarized beautifully by Rousseau in The Social Contract. Man is born free and everywhere he is in chains. Now, like death and taxes, nothing is more certain in this life than the fact that a self-evidently nonsensical nature of a statement will prove no barrier to it becoming the organizing principle of a culture. And such is the case with this claim. Human beings of all creatures on earth are born in a remarkable state of dependency upon others. My wife and I have the privilege, hopefully, of welcoming a granddaughter next March. If my son and my daughter-in-law abandon her in the woods, she will be dead within 72 hours. She is not born free. She is born in a state of absolute dependency. Compared to a tadpole or a hamster, we need our parents to provide for us and care for us for what one might consider to be a ridiculously long period of time. Jim reminded us all today over dinner that the male brain, I'm going to include the female brain, but the male brain is apparently not fully developed until the age of 30. My wife might say it's not fully developed even at the age of 54, but that is another matter. And yet this belief that the human condition is marked most naturally by autonomy and independence is a basic intuition of our culture. This has a number of implications. First, I think it places human beings naturally in an adversarial relationship to each other. If we are born free, then every human relationship is a potential link in that chain that restricts freedom and forces the individual to be inauthentic. This is no doubt, I think, why Rousseau sent 5 such links in his own chain of bondage, his children, to an orphanage. In those days, almost certainly a death sentence. Such a view is part of the recent amicus brief in the Dobbs case, filed by women athletes. This brief presents pregnancy and childbirth as preventing athletes from achieving their full, and I quote, human potential. That's an interesting turn of phrase, which indicates that autonomy and freedom are at the heart of what it means to be fully human. Abortion as a practice depends upon a view of pregnancy as potentially burdensome and the child in the womb as an alien presence in the woman's life that might well inhibit her being who she truly is. Second, when this notion of the self grips the popular imagination, it tilts society towards seeing any obvious form of external authority as inherently oppressive. Such oppression is not restricted to institutions, though they are perhaps the most obvious. It can be anything that acts in an external or heteronomous force, shaping the individual's identity, an historical narrative, a cultural expectation, an educational curriculum. Again, we see this all around us. I noted above the current problems facing family, church, and nation. While the presenting causes of the problems for each are different, all find themselves under pressure in a general culture of iconoclasm towards traditional institutional authority. The corruption of each may be real, but the desire to use such corruption to overthrow or discredit the institutions as institutions, as opposed to reforming and reviving them, is the result of the wider culture. And that culture is one that finds them implausible, not simply because they are corrupt, I would suggest, but also because they make demands and place restrictions upon the individual. One might say that society regards them as corrupt, not simply because of the particular sins that have marred their reputation over the years, but merely because they claim authority. Of course, the autonomous, free-floating self of Rousseau's philosophical fantasies and our current cultural mythology cannot exist in actuality. We are all shaped by culture in which we are placed and by the institutions which maintain that culture. And as family, church, and nation have faded, hospital and theatre have moved to centre stage. What is interesting is that these institutions are not only analgesic, to use Kolakowski's terminology, but preach the notion that the self is the center of the universe. Talking with a doctor over dinner, and I asked him, is it the case? It seems to be my impression that transgenderism is the one medical condition that a person can walk into a doctor's surgery and self-diagnose themselves with and not be challenged by the doctor without the doctor facing potential legal action. And he confirmed that's the case. It's kind of the ultimate placing of the self at the center, isn't it? The self is, and everything else must be adjusted to conform or to fit to the self. Our time of COVID has been interesting for the way in which one good, self-preservation from a single particular disease, has been pressed at the expense of all the others. My homeland, England, worrying statistics coming out of the number of surplus deaths now that will occur as a result of people not getting what would have been fairly routine cancer treatment during the last 2 years. As to theatre, we might perhaps expand the definition beyond that of Reef in the 1960s. Technology has broadened the scope and nature of the entertainment industry beyond that of cinema and television. While the evidence is somewhat anecdotal at present, it seems that the vast ocean of information available via the web has made it possible to engage in a highly selective construction of identity. We are all aware of the obvious ways in which this occurs. The conservative need never face a serious challenge to his thinking from reading a progressive, A progressive can studiously avoid any presentation of an opponent that does not cast said opponent as a bigoted idiot. But YouTube and TikTok are far more significant than simply providing a wide-ranging menu from which the customer can choose what to watch according to personal taste. They also play to and reinforce the mythology of the free self in at least three ways. First, they trade in narrative. And the expressive self, the modern self, is particularly attuned to narratives, whether of oppression or liberation. Abigail Schreier's disturbing but very enlightening study of the transgender craze. I would actually give Abigail Schreier the distinction of writing a book that I found more depressing than reading Rod's daily blog. And that is, I am setting the bar very high for depression there. I'm a pessimist, but I kind of dread 3:05 every afternoon when the email arrives in my... The YouTube subculture of transitioning videos, that's transitioning from one sex, one gender to the other gender, in defiance of biological sex, is predicated on a basic narrative of how individuals have moved from being oppressed by society with its gender norms to being liberated by outwardly asserting their own inner identity. If you watch some of these videos, they even give you instructions on how to subvert the authority of your parents. Very, very interesting and very, very disturbing. That resonates powerfully in a culture which sees individuals as born free and everywhere languishing in chains. Such a culture tilts naturally to the presentation of parents as oppressive figures whose job, traditionally understood as raising children to be adults through appropriate formation, is presented as a process by which the child is rendered inauthentic. Second, these social media platforms feed the idea that lies at the heart of expressive individualism. We are at our most authentic when we engage in performance, when, to use the common idiom, we let it all hang out. Of course, there are few things more artificial, in fact, than performance, but that is not the point. We do not think of such performances as artificial because they correspond so closely to the artificial notion of the self that is normative in our culture. Social media is, in fact, the most extreme example of the transformation of institutional purpose that Yuval Levine notes as a distinct characteristic of our day. Institutions are no longer places of formation, for that would oppress the modern self. Rather, they are places of performance where the modern self can be outwardly realized and thus fulfilled. I went to what you would call a public school funded by the government in England, but it was a very traditional boys' school. You had to pass a test to go in, and it was a sort of, you were creamed off and sent to this school where the purpose of the school was, I always say, to crush individuality. You go to school, you wore a uniform. I remember well an incident walking home from school, where the second master, the vice principal of my school, saw that my shirt was hanging out, and he called me out for bringing the name of the school into public disrepute. Unbelievable. I say that to my kids in class today, and their eyes are like saucers. You know, why didn't your parents sue him, kind of thing, for oppressing you? I say, well, that's not the point. It was a boys' school, and the point was you went there in order to be made part of the team. That's why sports, cricket and rugby were so important, because you went there not to be an individual, but to be part of the team. My rebellion was doing classics, not engineering. That was my one. What kind of rebellion is that? That was my token rebellion at the end of my school days. I didn't do the science that was demanded of me. Third, such platforms play to the general technological myth that the world is essentially just stuff. A kind of cosmic Play-Doh, which has no sense or shape or moral significance in itself, but is simply there for our wills to manipulate and control. This helps explain why problems that might once have been regarded as having a moral dimension, those associated with promiscuous sexual behavior, for example, are now treated as technical problems to be solved by the application of instrumental reason and scientific knowledge. Catch a disease? Well, take an antibiotic. Become pregnant without intending to do so, have an abortion. From a Christian perspective, we might hear echo the words of that. He's not a well-known Christian philosopher, he's a well-known philosopher, the words of Heidegger, that the danger of technology does not come in the first instance from the lethal killing machines it has produced. It comes rather from the way it makes human beings think about their world and their place within it. One that is fundamentally amoral, I would suggest, and dehumanizing from a Christian perspective. To this myth of mastery that technology carries with it, we should also add the emergence of the phenomenon of social acceleration. Technological innovations transform the way we experience the world. I'm a Reformation man by background. I've only been sort of radicalized by the LGBTQ movement and its impact on freedom of religion and freedom of speech and upon children. My training is in 16th century. Well, the printing press was invented in the 15th century and it fueled the rise of literacy. It facilitated the transmission of ideas across time and space in faster, more stable, and more geographically wide-ranging forms. It played a key role in disrupting and transforming the structures of power in Europe, along with the rise of cities and trade. And without doubt, it was a necessary precondition for and formative cause of the Reformation. It is arguable that it took 150 years of social disruption and conflict for Europe to come to terms with the changes that the printing press and trade generated and regain some level of social and political stability. Think about that, 150 years of comparative chaos. In the modern era, technological changes, of which there was one major one in the 15th, 16th century, the printing press. In the modern era, technological changes come so fast that societies are incapable of assimilating them before the next change arrives. Bought a new car the other year. Man, I can't even put a CD in the... It doesn't have a CD anymore. Very frustrating to an idiot like me who doesn't know how to use technology. I can't assimilate the change. Extrapolate that to the whole of society. The result is what we call social acceleration, the feeling that life in all its dimensions, because our lives are affected in all dimensions by technology, from the home and the workplace and the nation, is in a state of constant change and instability and flux. One result of this is the feeling of vertigo that many of us experience when we look at the changes around us, where all that is solid seems constantly to melt into air. Another result, more pertinent to the topic of this paper, is that it further undermines the notion that there is any stable meaning or significance in either the world as a whole or in human nature in particular. It is another facet of the way in which technology serves to transform the notion of the self and clear the way for the idea of self-creation. Marx, in the Communist Manifesto, clearly understood that technology was going to transform the way human beings understood themselves. Marx could have had no idea about what that would mean when technology was moving so fast. Technology, in this way, has served to make strands of 19th century thought far more plausible in the 20th and 21st centuries. Nietzsche's dismantling of human nature and his placement of the artist, the self-creator, who bends his first nature to create his second nature is one example. In Nietzsche's day, Oscar Wilde, the dandy, the aesthete, the sexual transgressor, the supreme individualist, was perhaps the greatest example. In our day, TikTok and YouTube allow us all to be cut-price Oscars, constantly performing our carefully curated selves before the watching world, only without the perennial wit and actual talent. Then the combination of Hegel, Nietzsche, and Marx in Western Marxism, and the various branches of critical theory, put to the service of an iconoclastic view of the past as oppressive, parallels the technological myth that the past is oppressive and liberation lies in overcoming that past. As Augusto Del Noce commented, the ideal of technological civilization, and I quote, is nothing but the latest form of the millennialist heresy, now completely secularized. Technology is the necessary precondition for the self-creating self and the power with which we embrace that notion which now bestrides our world. To deny the self is to destroy the self. Given the institutional, philosophical, and technological shifts in society that have served to create the modern self, the expressive individual, we might summarize the notion of self-denial in our contemporary Western world in this way. To deny the self is to destroy the self. To quote William Blake from the aptly named Marriage of Heaven and Hell, he who desires but acts not breeds pestilence. Of course, as I pointed out with reference to Rousseau's Basic Anthropology, this is a myth. Not simply myth in the terms of it grips the imagination and shapes the way we behave. It's a myth in the fact that it isn't actually true. Even today, society only recognizes as legitimate the outward expression of certain desires or identities. The LGBTQ activist is deemed a virtuous member of society, whilst the Klansman or the serial killer is not. Increasingly, of course, the conservative Christian is being moved towards that latter category for the simple reason that not all identities are compatible, and somebody somewhere ultimately has to decide who is allowed to play in society's team and who should be placed in the sin bin. But even so, the ordering myth of the day is that of personal autonomy and the consequent evil of anything that might impose an identity upon the individual from the outside, or demand that that identity be found in something beyond the individual's personal desires. And in that world, as I say, to deny the self is surely to destroy the self. Christianity and the self. Given the above, it should be clear that the question of the significance and importance of self-denial cannot be separated from broader questions about the significance of reality in general. And this, of course, is where the most fundamental difference between Christianity and the contemporary Western cultural imagination is to be found. Put bluntly, is the world just stuff? Does it have a meaning and a structure which need to be respected? The Christian answer is, of course, yes. The heavens declare the glory of God. Praise to God has been ordained from the lips of infants and children. As Genesis 1 and 2 indicate, the world was not set forth as a lump of cosmic Play-Doh to be bent to the will of whatever creature happens to be the strongest. Even before any contemplation of the fall upon human beings, this places a very different view of the self at the center of the Christian faith to that which is deemed plausible today. In the account of creation in Genesis, self-creation is simply not a possibility, either absolutely in terms of existence or personally in terms of essence. The self is realized by discovering the structure of the world and living in accordance with it. It is also noteworthy that the one problem in creation before the fall is the loneliness of Adam. He needs companionship. He needs Eve. He is only truly and fully himself when he stands in relationship of dependency and obligation towards another. When we think about it, it becomes clear that the notion of human autonomy, which dominates our world today, is simply not biblical. To be in relation to others is always to sacrifice some level of freedom or autonomy in the absolute sense. And that can be truly beautiful, as friendships and loving marriages indicate. I was touched at hearing about the number of grandchildren that Peter has and the number of grandchildren that Jim have. Testimonies to people who've sacrificed themselves in giving themselves to another. That's a beautiful thing. The creation narrative gives further content to this by indicating that the world, far from being simply the matter from which it is made, has a moral structure and a telos, an end. Again, this requires that the self be realized, not through free and unhindered self-expression, but rather by self-denial that conforms to the structure. In other words, that means respecting the moral structure of the world in a way that preempts any other judgments human beings might take care to make about what is good or useful for self-realization. A careful reflection on the temptation of Eve illustrates this. When the serpent points her to the fruit of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, the text tells us that she saw that the fruit was good for food, a delight to the eyes, and would make her wise. In doing so, she makes two kinds of judgment, I think, that motivate her eating. She makes an aesthetic one relative to the tree's outward attractiveness and taste, presumably, or guessing at its taste, and a pragmatic one relative to its utility. What she does not do is set these two judgments in the broader context of the moral structure of God's creation. We might say that she places herself and her own needs and desires at the center of the universe, and then engages that universe on her own terms. She creates the moral interpretation of God's command not to eat, that it will prevent her from reaching her full human potential. Eve is thus the archetypal and paradigmatic modern self. Ethical judgments today, it seems to me, are often merely aesthetic or pragmatic and serve the self. The notion of external authority as necessary to the proper formation of the self is rejected as oppressive. My other educational story is, I don't know if Peter experienced this when he graduated from Cambridge, but all of the male graduands had to line up against a wall, raise our pants, our trousers by a couple of inches, and have the head porter, my college man called Mr. Monument, terrifying man in a funeral suit with a bowler hat on, inspect our socks, because every sock had to be the same shade of black. Otherwise, you weren't graduating. It's amazing when I go to American graduations, no two kids look the same, and I'm saying, this is terrible. We've taught these kids to be individuals. We've not crushed their individuality and made them part of the team. Another example, the closing chapters of Judges, where, of course, the refrain, at that time there was no king in Israel, is used on a number of occasions. The writer of Judges is not, of course, simply making a chronological point. I think he is making a chronological point. He's locating the events before the kingdom. But he's also making a moral point, because, of course, Israel did have a king, the Lord God. She was choosing to live as if this was not true. The most terrifying example of this king-free existence, of course, occurs in Judges 19, where an unnamed Levite's concubine is raped and then murdered. The drama starts with the Levite being subject to excessive and even comical hospitality from his father-in-law to his arrival in a town where, worryingly, there is a disturbing lack of hospitality, and then it moves to the violent sexual assault of his concubine. That he is apparently willing to sacrifice her to save his own skin is bad enough. That the text leaves open whether she dies as a result of the rape or of the dismemberment by her husband is even more disturbing. The dehumanizing effect of having no king, of living life in accordance merely with reference to the will of human beings without reference to a sacred order, is evident. Indeed, that the passage in Judges 19 draws, I think, about one-third of its language and phraseology from Genesis 19, where the men of Sodom attempt to gang rape Lot, is clearly an intentional literary device. The writer is making the point that the chosen people are as bad as anyone when they choose to live for themselves rather than in accordance with the rule of God. When external authority is removed, the self collapses into an agent of anarchic, dehumanizing violence. Having unhitched the earth from the sun, to use Nietzsche's famous phrase, the men of Benjamin must become gods themselves. And what terrible and terrifying gods they become. In the New Testament, the submission of the self to external authority is explicitly given a new dimension, that of suffering. The cross, as Luther pointed out at the Heidelberg Disputation, becomes the lens through which reality is to be understood. At the risk of stating the banal, Christ himself is the great example of this, with his submission to God's will, even to the point of suffering and death, as the means of inaugurating his kingdom, makes clear. Here comes a quotation from a Protestant text. Question 42 of the Westminster Larger Catechism summarizes Christ's mediation as follows. Question 42, why was our mediator called Christ? Answer, our mediator was called Christ because he was anointed with the Holy Ghost above measure and so set apart and fully furnished with all authority and ability to execute the offices of prophet, priest, and king of his church in the estate both of his humiliation and exaltation. Christ is mediator both in humiliation and in exaltation. There is, in other words, a dramatic movement in the life of Christ whereby his exaltation is predicated upon his prior humiliation. His incarnation, suffering, and death serve as a vital, non-negotiable backdrop to his sovereign rule and indeed to the nature of his kingdom, this side of his glorious return. Baptism, with its connotations of judgment, makes this aspect of judgment, contradiction, and suffering central, not simply to the life of Christ, but also to the lives of Christians in general. The most powerful exposition of this in the New Testament, I think, is Paul's letter of 2 Corinthians, where he defends his ministry against the accusations that its outward weakness and suffering indicates that he lacks authority and authenticity. The problem he faces is that some in Corinth have had their imaginations gripped by the culture around them, with its emphasis on physical beauty, technical oratory, and the trappings of worldly success. Paul's response is that the logic of the cross is antithetical to the wisdom of the world, and that the things which make his ministry implausible in a worldly sense are precisely those things that reflect that logic. I don't think Paul is making the case that all faithful ministry and all faithful Christians must experience the outward contradiction and suffering, physical and mental, that he endures. But he's making the point that such suffering is not in itself destructive of the self. Rather, it can be a vital part of personal formation in terms of Christ-likeness. And above all, it is ultimately to be relativized in relation to the glory of eternity and subverted to the Christian's greater good. Suffering, of course, is, as noted earlier, perhaps the most meaningless phenomena to the modern analgesic mind. If the idea of the world as having a moral structure is implausible, how much more so the idea that suffering might be an integral part of what it now means in a fallen world to be truly human. No wonder that the church has such a plausibility problem. And that brings me, finally, to Christianity's, well, not quite penultimately, Christianity's plausibility problem. Given the above, it is clear that the church needs to understand that she stands in basic antithesis to the wider culture in terms of her way of thinking about and imagining the world, the human condition within the world, and the significance in particular of external authority and self-denial. The presenting issue she faces, LGBTQ+ activism, the new racism of the woke, whatever, these are merely functions of much deeper conflicts of how Christianity sees the world and how the world sees the world. This is proving particularly hard, I think, in America, and particularly hard among conservative Protestants, where certain unique pathologies grip the Christian mind. First, there is the perennial problem faced by the church and exemplified by Paul's interactions with the Corinthians. The Christians themselves are always allowing the values of the surrounding culture to flavor and even reshape their understanding of the gospel. Peter talked this morning about we all worship Mammon in some way and to some degree. The identification of the goods, often the legitimate goods, of the earthly city with those of the city of God is a constant temptation. And that means in our particular context that the values of the therapeutic society have come to shape the life of the church. Prosperity teaching is simply the most banal and crude example. The identification of political causes, right and left, with the kingdom is a less obvious but often equally problematic one. The consumer mentality towards church, an unfortunate but it seems inevitable corollary of the real political and social good of freedom of religion, fosters an approach to church commitment that tilts towards placing the felt needs and preferences of the individual at the center. The task of the church is that of self-denial. The pattern of church life today seems predicated too often on self-realization. chatting to a friend, a Catholic friend, the deacon in his parish had started to preach pro-abortion homilies, which blows my mind that Catholics would want to be liberal Protestants. It hasn't worked very well for us. You're welcome to try it, but it doesn't seem to have worked very well for us. But I was struck when I said to my friend, what are you going to do about church? He said, well, I don't have any choice. I have to go to the church where I reside. I have to go to attend church in the parish where I reside. And it struck me that's not a Protestant way of thinking about it at all. As a Protestant, I might want to say to him, maybe you should think about moving on. But then the price can so often be, well, I didn't like the pastor's tie, or I didn't like the choice of him last Sunday. Maybe I'll try the church 2 miles down the road. And technology, of course, has enabled that. The motor car, the automobile. Yet more worrying is the manner in which many Christians, including many leading figures, still seem to think that the cultured despisers of religion can be placated if they stand shoulder to shoulder with them on common causes. Most notably, I think, in our own day, the race issue, and engage in the liturgy of self-loathing that seems to have been internalized by so many Christians. This is particularly problematic among the leadership of conservative Protestantism, I think, in America. Just in recent weeks, the establishment gushing over Francis Collins that characterized his tenure and has been galvanized in recent weeks by his retirement is remarkable for its emphasis on him as an example of faithful presence. And as far as I can see, it's complete silence on his complicity in abortion and positive advocacy of LGBTQ plus identity. Two, it would seem to me, of the most obvious symptoms of the worldliness of our contemporary culture. Two of the most obvious ways in which the Christian notion of selfhood and the virtue of self-denial have been repudiated. Faithful presence purchased, it seems, at the cost of actual faithfulness. And while the left is perhaps the dominant strain in this, there is also the problem of those on the right who identify a particular vision of America with the gospel, often decried in the media as Christian nationalism. I believe this movement to be by and large culturally impotent, its angry rhetoric being symptomatic of people who feel they have no power. It certainly controls none of the institutions of cultural power or influence, but in an odd way it parallels the establishment evangelicalism of the officer class, the politics of ressentiment, that which always blames the other side. And blaming the other side for all of our problems, of course, has a certain analgesic quality to it when it comes to our own personal responsibility. Yet setting aside the ill-placed concerns of the loudest Christian voices, whether of the establishment or the populists, the most important thing we all need to understand is the depth of the general problem we face. Merely addressing the symptoms of the malaise will not help. We need to grasp the foundation of the problem. To reiterate, we are facing a battle over what it means to be a human being, or even over whether it means anything at all. Is the self self-creating? In which case, self-denial is self-destructive. Or is the self made in God's image? In which case, self-denial is the path to self-realization. Failure to grasp this will leave us confused by the rapid changes taking place around us. If the self is free, autonomous, and focused on inner psychological fulfillment, then it is no surprise that the civic virtues which have allowed Christianity to prosper are now under severe pressure. The psychologized analgesic mind sees words as weapons and ideas as oppressive, because in that imaginative universe, they are real weapons and they are truly oppressive. It finds freedom of speech and freedom of religion dangerous. It makes sense, I think, when you understand that self-denial is a problem. That is somewhat paradoxical, of course. If the self is free, why are freedoms falling? Isn't the repudiation of self-denial an assertion of radical liberty? On the surface, yes. In practice, however, freedom of speech and religion enable others to deny ourselves. These liberties facilitate self-denial of another form, heteronymous and hostile, denial of my chosen self by another. Somebody sent me a quotation from Kamala Harris yesterday. She was talking to some children, and I'm paraphrasing here, but I think it's pretty close. Never allow anyone to tell you who you are. You tell them who you are. Oh, man, if I'd said that to my second master that day he caught me with my shirt untucked, gosh, I would not have lived to tell the tale. And my parents would have supported him in his action. This is why a major Canadian university this year held a Trans Day of Visibility and accompanied it with an announcement that read, and I quote, "We are done with tolerance, acceptance, and passive support. We demand appreciation, celebration, and love for trans lives." Self-creation, at least in the forms promoted by the most effective lobby groups and the most powerful and compelling intersectional rhetoric, must be celebrated by all, not merely tolerated. Hence the weird phenomenon we are currently witnessing, the triumph of a highly subjective libertarian notion of the self, fueling the rise of forms of formal and informal totalitarianism. Christianity's opportunity. It would be easy to end here on a somewhat apocalyptic note about how the death of Christianity and the death of democratic freedoms seem to be occurring simultaneously and to be fueled by the same phenomenon, a shift of the cultural imagination towards a view of the self as self-creating rather than self-denying. But that's not an option for the Christian. God is sovereign and remains so. In light of that, how are we to live? There is no easy solution here, precisely because the problem is, in a deep and real sense, a matter of the broader way in which we are all quietly taught to imagine ourselves and the world around us. The answer, therefore, has to capture the imagination in some way. And in a world where the most authoritative voices in our lives come from the screens at which we gaze, and where reality is mediated to us via technology, and social accelerative technology at that, the reforming of the imagination is not an easy, perhaps even an impossible task. By the way, I would add, one of the things I've become aware of through talking to the undergraduates at Grove, you fool yourself if you think that the most important influences in your children's lives are the people who are actually physically present to them. Parents and teachers, they're the enemy now. It's TikTok and YouTube. You can send your kids to the best Christian school in the country. You can homeschool your kids, but if you give them a smartphone, it's all done. You've undone it. But then you face the difficult issue, okay, I don't give my kid a smartphone. Do I not allow my kid to go and play with his or her friends who own smartphones? I see no easy way out of this particular dilemma. Of course, what is impossible with man is possible with God. We must never allow ourselves to be so mesmerized by the power of the imminent world around us that we lose sight of the fact that God is sovereign, that the gospel is powerful, and that neither of those depend ultimately on our strength or technical ability. But that is also no excuse for passivity. And so in closing, I want to suggest just a few elements of church strategy. First, I think we need to be aware of the dynamics of the world in which we live. An old psychoanalyst acquaintance of mine used to recite almost as a mantra to me that, quote, "to know the script is to change the script." It's a cliche, but I think what he was getting at there is that self-awareness is important and transformative. In itself, it may not be a complete solution, but it is certainly a necessary precondition to the solution. Being aware of the seductive blandishments of the world around us gives us at least the possibility of some form of resistance. Second, liturgy, preaching, and catechizing must do at least two things. They must promote understanding of the whole counsel of God. I think one of the temptations at a time of, I hate to use the cliched word, crisis, is that we can get very focused on the presenting issues. And it's appropriate. Different points in history, different issues rise to the surface that require particular attention. But we must not allow that to distract us from the whole counsel of God. Resistance to the world at one point must arise from a broad understanding of reality as a whole. And that reality is God's reality. Further, it must focus on things above. To keep this world in perspective, a heavenly perspective is required That is Paul's consistent claim in his letters. It should be the priority of our worship and our teaching. I love that paragraph in Hans's book on the beatific vision, where he takes to task those who say, you know, if you're heavenly minded, you're of no earthly good. And he makes the point, no, it's only the heavenly minded who are ultimately of any earthly good. That, I think, resonates with the Pauline note of 2 Corinthians and Colossians, etc. Third, we must be prepared for suffering and contradiction. The decades where the moral imagination of the world and that of the church were broadly compatible in terms of their practical outworkings, they may have been different in origin, but they were broadly compatible in terms of their practical outworkings, these are gone. Not only are they gone, they now stand opposed at many points. And that means we need to shift to seeing self-denial by way of suffering as being the likely normative pattern of the future, set, of course, against the background of the eternal focus to which I alluded above. Fourth, we need to discipline ourselves. It's hard. But casual church attendance and church hopping based on personal preferences, so rife in many church quarters, are merely indicative of the worldliness of the church today, and we need to acknowledge this. I'm not aware of how belonging to the body of Christ operates at a sort of technical local level in Orthodoxy or Roman Catholicism. Certainly in Presbyterianism, when individuals come into communicant membership in the church, they take vows. They take vows before God. I take vows as an ordained minister. I don't see that my vows, they differ in content, but they differ not a whit in seriousness from the vows taken by church members. And that, I think, means that casually drifting from one church to another because, quote, they weren't loving enough, which in my experience is the catch-all for I wanted to leave and couldn't think of anything specific on which to do it for. I think members need to take their vows seriously too. Those are vows taken before God. I take my ordination vows very seriously, and if I feel I'm in breach of them, or I change my opinions in such a way that I can no longer teach according to the teachings of my church, then I would have to resign and ask to be released from my vows at that point. It requires self-policing that is very counterintuitive in a rights-based individualistic culture. But I think we have to start somewhere. Put it this way. Maybe your example of self-discipline could have a huge impact upon your children and your grandchildren in that regard. And finally, we need to present people with a magnificent vision of God and his gospel. And nothing, I think, does this better than the presentation of a glorious doctrine of God. I teach a doctrine of God course at Grove to undergraduates, and we spend a lot of time reading the prayers of people like Gregory of Nazianzus, his theological orations, the meditations of Anselm. We look at the prayers of Luther and Calvin. And I'm struck at how many of the students are blown away by the prayers of these men because it grips their imagination. I don't object when they say that Tolkien grips their imagination. I like Tolkien myself, but I'd rather Gregory of Nazianzus grip their imagination. We need to present a magnificent vision of God and his gospel in what we sing, what we say, what we pray, what we hear in church. The glory of God must be shown forth. Only that will ultimately grab the imagination. And only that will ultimately place the self made in the image of that glorious God, in some kind of context and perspective. Thank you very much.
So thank you very much, Carl. And I once again, I want to invite anybody down to ask questions to either of these microphones. It's a wonderful talk.
Okay. Thank you, Dr. Schumann. I will try not to ask too many questions, but I have two that have to do with the church and Charles Taylor's idea of the social imaginary. I appreciate what you said about certain cultural pathologies gripping the imagination of the church, and I think that many of the intuitions you brought up this evening, I recognize myself as being intuitive, and I have a hard time saying why it is that that's not quite right, let alone try to talk to someone else about it. So what I'd like to know is it possible for the church to escape that social imaginary without belonging to another culture, or must it form a sort of culture of its own, which is dubious, or is it better to attempt to contribute to the social imaginary? And this is my second question, is how is it possible for an institution, I guess, to do that, to contribute to the imaginative part?
Great question. I'm not meant to repeat this for the people online. They will have heard that, because there's no way I can repeat that. It's okay. I think it's a good question. I think there are a number of facets. I think, first of all, I think Charles Taylor is, I'm very appreciative of his notion of the social imaginary. It opened a lot of vistas for me. It enabled me to see a lot of things I hadn't seen before. And I think it escalated the problem in my mind as well, because you realize, wow, the problem is it's comprehensive. How do you get outside of this thing to change it? And the answer is you can't. So how might we sort of resist aspects of it? Well, I would say a couple of things. One, identity. I think we all have various identities. And one of the things that I've become very convinced of over the last few years really is the strongest identities we have come from the strongest communities to which we belong. I'm a professor, I'm a father, I'm a husband. I would say being a professor is a big part of my identity, but it's not like being a father or a husband. I can change jobs, I can retire. There are all these things that I can see myself doing. I'm an Englishman. I'm a patriotic Englishman. I make a distinction between patriotism and nationalism just because I think my country, mostly my wife, is the most beautiful woman in the world. It doesn't mean I'm insulting every other woman in the world. Just because I think my country is the greatest in the world doesn't mean I'm insulting other people's country. I think that's patriotism, not nationalism. When you think about that, well, what's the church trying to do? I think the church is trying to, the task of the church is to make sure that the strongest identity that a person has is that they're a Christian. And that means, I think, that the church has to be the strongest community to which a person belongs. So I think Rod's Benedict option, with its emphasis on community, is really important. I think when you read the Acts of the Apostles, you get a vision of the church there as a community, not just a place to go and hear the word preached on a Sunday, but a true community. These people are looking after each other. Again, I think Peter mentioned this morning the way that things were held in common. It's not communism, but when people were struggling and suffering, there was money there to help them. So I think we need to think in those terms about the church as a way of forging Christianity's strong identity. What kind of identity should be forged? Well, here, I suspect there will be differences in this room, because we're each going to think about the task of the church in a slightly different way. But I'm a Presbyterian. The primary task of the church is to preach the word, central, and then to administer the sacraments. And I think that is how I would want to see I want to see that at the heart of the community, the sound proclamation of the word and the administration of the sacraments. I'm guessing if you're Orthodox or Catholic, you nuance that somewhat differently, but those elements are going to be there in any Christian tradition. There has to be proclamation, there has to be sacraments. So I think the best way for Christians to counter the dominance, if I could put it this way, of the intuitions of the social imaginary is to be the strongest community to which a Christian belongs. That has problems associated with it, the motor car, etc., etc. But we need to think about that. That brings me then, leading from that, to the second half. So should the church be engaged in getting out there and transforming the culture? I'm not really your classic transformationalist when it comes to culture. The transformationists generally dislike me intensely on that point. But I would say Christians should be transforming their culture, but they do it as Christians in their local context. I don't think Jesus is taking out Congress over any time soon. I don't think that I can have, the people I can have most impact on, the culture that I can most shape, is the culture of my home, the culture of my neighborhood, and the culture of the place I work. And that's where I want to focus my energies. And I think that arises out of the matrix of me being a strong Christian in my local church. So I want to see transformed lives transforming neighborhoods and local institutions. I think we're very, because Christianity, particularly white Protestant Christianity, has been such a force in American culture for so long and is rapidly losing that place, it's hard for a lot of evangelical American Christians to imagine what the world is like. By the time I became a Christian in the early 1980s, Christianity was totally marginal already in England. So what's happening appalls me but doesn't shock me, if I could put it that way. And I think, well, we just need to do what we always do. We need to be good and faithful Christians in our local context. We can't abandon the culture because most of us have loans and mortgages and jobs that tie us into the culture. So we can't pull out completely. But we have to be realistic about what we can do in the culture. And there's not a lot I can do nationally. I don't even have a vote. I'm a green carder. I don't have a vote here. I don't have a vote back home now either because I've been away too long. I'm a voteless person. I can't influence things that way. But I can have an influence when I open my home, as what we'll do next Friday, to students in one of my classes at Grove. I can be an influence that way. So probably not a very satisfactory answer, but I think simple things. I don't think we should overthink this. I think simple hospitality and a local focus might be the way to have most impact.
Thank you.
Yes, my question is
an old nemesis from Westminster. James, good to see you.
That's wonderful. It's going to take the form of a tentative suggestion of a refinement to the thesis in your wonderful book and to get your response to it, which is with the assertion of absolute autonomy and self-sufficiency, the performance, you know, in theater and that. I want to suggest that there is, that it's not just those things, but there is a particular expression of that which is particularly important and ultimate, and that is transgression. And so, you know, in Reif's categories, political man, religious man, economic man, psychological man is succeeded by transgressive man.
Yeah.
The third order, the paradox is the third order, which would abolish all standards, really can't do it because it always needs some new standard to transgress against so that the process of transgression never has an end. It is a world in which Satan and the fall of Satan and the disobedience of Eve are seen as the ultimate heroic figures to be admired and emulated. And you know, continue in this vein, but your response to that.
I find that entirely plausible. I think it's consistent with an Augustinian understanding of human sinful motivation. I think Freud nails it when he says, you know, nothing gives you a thrill like transgression. It's because it's wrong that you get a buzz from it. I find that entirely plausible, and I think we see the fruits of that all around us. I mean, people say, you know, do you think transgenderism is going to be the worst? And I quote that bit from King Lear. As long as you can say it is the worst, it is not the worst. I have no idea where it might go next. But it seems to me, yep, transgression lies absolutely at the heart of it. So I seem to remember you would modify my theses at Westminster. You've successfully done it again, brother. Thank you very much.
He was here before I was.
Okay.
If individual autonomy and the doing away with all traditional responsibilities which previously gave people identities is the thrust of, I guess, the modern identity, why do you think in America that it has taken a sexual direction almost exclusively?
Yeah. That's interesting. I think in general, One could say that one could give an anthropological answer to the sexual revolution in general and say that for most of us, sexual desires are a very powerful part of what we experience. And they do hold a certain compelling attraction. So it's possible to make the case, I think, that human beings tilt towards the sexual on that front. Why America in particular? That's interesting. And the Italian philosopher I quoted, Augusto Del Noce, in an article, I think written in 1970, made the comment that the sexual revolution would triumph most dramatically in America, which, given its Puritan heritage, sounds counterintuitive. I wonder if it's that the heart of the American project, autonomy is very important to Americans. 1776 is a fascinating moment in human history because you invented a nation for the first time. My nation was not invented, it just emerged over a long period of time. The Americans did something remarkable. They did take something that looked fixed and demonstrated that it was just stuff that they could impose themselves over. And as an outsider in American culture, I've always been struck by the tremendous self-confidence that Americans have in individualism and individual power. I start my humanities course at Grove with the Sartre quotation, man is condemned to be free. And none of them can understand it because they're all Americans. freedom's, but I say, if you come from Europe, man, that sentence really makes sense. I think the combination perhaps of a radical emphasis upon freedom and the anthropological tilt towards sexuality or towards sex is perhaps a lethal combination. But it is an interesting phenomenon that even now, while other countries in the world are sort of showing signs that they may pull back from some of the extremes of the trans madness, America seems to be pushing full steam ahead. Very disturbing. Very disturbing. So good observation question. Not sure I have an exhaustive answer, but my suspicion is it lies in the distinctive liturgy of rights and freedom that Americans have. And that is, don't get me wrong, is generally a very good thing. But like technology, brings certain unique risks with it as well.
Thank you so much for your talk. I'm a person who has grown up in this very individualistic culture. And what is one to do? Like, I mean that seriously. I didn't go to an all-boys school. I didn't play team sports. I ran cross country. It's kind of a paradox because I'm an individual. I don't really have strong connections with like a really deep community. I have my church, but it's like, how does an individual escape individualism? You see what I mean? Like, it's kind of funny, but it's also a serious question.
That's a good question. And I think it goes to the heart of the problem, that it's easy to analyze this, but as I've said, it's the water we swim in. So it's a bit up. But you're asking the question. So if I can go back to one of the things I said towards the end, to know the script is to change the script. You're asking the question, which is more than most people do. So you're already taking a step in the right direction. I would say, find ways to be committed. Find ways to commit to other people. I don't know you at all, but if you've got a girlfriend, is she the one you're going to marry? Marry her. Marry her early. Have kids. a good friend of mine, Mark Dever, pastor of Capitol Hill Baptist Church in Washington. I can't remember, but he preached a sermon that I heard online once, and I can't remember the title. It was something like "Burn Bridges." It was "Close Down Options Early and Often." That was the title. And his comment then, this may be 20 years ago, saying the problem today is that young people are drowning in a sea of options. Shut down your options. You have to do that as an individual. You have to freely do that as an individual. But find things to commit to. Find communities to be involved in. Find people to serve. Find ways of realizing the fact that you are somebody with, you know, defined by obligations and dependencies. Now, that's going to look different for different people. For me, I'm a husband and a father, and I'm soon to be grandfather. My obligations are obvious, and they're there, and there's nothing I can do about them. You're at a different stage in your life, but find those people that you can commit yourself to and commit to them. Close down your options.
Thank you. That was a very good answer.
Thank you, Dr. Truman. You had mentioned in your talk this notion of the modern primacy of formation of the self through TikTok and YouTube over that of the family and other institutions. Often, like as you had mentioned, these things darken and obscure reality. First, I wanted to give an encouragement to those parents out there, as someone who's grown up in this age, an encouragement through a quote of Michael Hanby, and then I have a question after that. Michael Hanby says, "The gift of creation is irrevocable. The truth of nature cannot be completely annihilated, however deeply and darkly it can be obscured. Reality is better than all our theories about it. It is a presupposition of all the violence we do to it." As the obscuration of reality through, I think, our technological age continues, I just wanted to ask if you could give more encouraging anecdotes from your teaching of undergraduates of maybe revelations they've seen of reality, of God, of the world in the midst of this dark technological age that wants to obscure it.
Well, that's a great question. I'm conscious as I answer that the students I teach are not they're not a representative cross-section of young people in the United States. Grove City College has a distinctive history. We tend to draw on distinctive type of student, generally from fairly conservative backgrounds, whether Christian or not. But I've been immensely encouraged at Grove by the appetite my students have for great works of literature and for serious Christian worship. Again, in the Doctrine of God course, it's fascinating talking to them about the pulpit prayers that they hear. And I'm not one for getting them to disrespect their pastor, who almost certainly serves them faithfully and sacrificially. So I'm not in the game of getting them to compare their pastor to Gregory of Nazianzus. But I'm in the game of getting them to think about what's possible relative to the glories of the Christian faith. And I found them very receptive to that. Now again, students electing to take my courses are not even representative perhaps of all Grove students. But I think there are those out there, they hunger for roots. They hunger to belong to something bigger than themselves. And they find the world around answer to be thoroughly inadequate. And they're bright enough to know that. I absolutely agree with your quotation from Michael. My concern is always that, well, yeah, you can't fight nature indefinitely, but you can do an awful lot of damage along the way. You know, I think the trans thing, I think 100 years from now, the trans issue will be the equivalent of lobotomies. I genuinely do. I think people look back on our age and they'll wonder why certain people weren't languishing in prison. Certain doctors, maybe certain parents, insurance companies. I think we'll look back and say, what were they doing allowing those monsters to walk the streets? But between now and then, an awful lot of human beings are going to be mutilated and suffer and have their lives destroyed. So I am optimistic on that front in the long term, and I think Michael's right. But I also think that, I always think of Jezebel. Elijah scores this spectacular victory against Jezebel. He demonstrates to her in a most dramatic way what reality is on Mount Carmel. And her immediate response is, so help me if your head is on your shoulders this time, tonight, you know, later tonight. As human beings, we have an infinite capacity, it seems to me, to ignore reality and desperately try to make it conform with our own desires. And that way always leads to pain and suffering.
Go ahead.
Yeah. Thanks, Carl, for your great talk. I think you're right on the money with analgesic and therapeutic culture. And I work with high schoolers, particularly a lot of affluent high schoolers. And I see it acutely on display where, especially after COVID and a lot of their social skills have eroded, I'm seeing more and more of them go to therapists who will then give them antidepressants, but the pain doesn't go away. So I see them then go to more therapists and then have therapists on call, and some of them even getting admitted to mental institutions. And so I would love some insight onto what you might say, not just to those high schoolers, but just to anyone in pain, given your insights into pain.
Yeah, that's a very good question. And like a lot of pastoral questions, it does not lend itself to a, because every situation always has its uniquenesses, it doesn't lend itself to a particularly satisfactory, here's the silver bullet. I would say the first thing that needs to be done is that the pain needs to be acknowledged as real. I'm not keen on the language of snowflake that's used about the rising generation, because that implies that they're just weaker. A silly example I use in class is I'll say to one of the students, I say, do you own a smartphone? Yes, okay, give me a smartphone. I'll give it you back in 2 years' time. How are you going to feel about that? And they, oh, that's awful. I'm going to feel terrible. And I say, and is that feeling real? And they'll say, well, yes. And I say, well, yeah, but it didn't exist 20 years ago. But it is a real pain now. And so I don't like the language of snowflake in dealing with young people, because I think the pains they feel are real. When I was growing up, social acceptance involved being accepted by the 7 or 8 guys I hung around with on a regular basis. Now social acceptance means being liked by a potentially infinite number of people on Facebook or TikTok or whatever. It's a much more fragile and terrifying world, I think, on that level for individuals. So the first thing I'd want to do is take the pain very, very seriously indeed. And then I'd want to listen to why they felt that way. And then I'd make a judgment on, do I need to send them to a counseling service? Do I need to send them to see a general practitioner? So those are the kind of things that I would focus on. And I think in general I would encourage them. My experience of this has been it almost always comes down to social media usage. And I would encourage discipline on social media. But I think that your task is hopeless if the parents aren't supportive. I was speaking at an elite Christian school. It's interesting that the only real opposition I've had to the stuff I've been saying recently has tended to come from Christians, not from the progressives. And I met with some of the faculty, and one of the women teachers asked me a question. I didn't have any way to answer it. She said, what do you do when a 17-year-old girl tells you that her parents, this is a Christian school, are paying for her to have breast enhancements for her 18th birthday? And I said, I have no idea, because whatever you say makes no difference if the parents aren't on board. So I think I'd want to talk to the parents as well. And if they're not supportive, you don't stand a chance. So.
Thank you.
You know, Carl, before I ask a question, I want to make a comment about what you said about about social media influencing the young. When I was in Poland doing research for Live Not By Lies, I talked to so many young Catholics there who told me that they expect the faith to collapse within 10 years. Poland will be like Ireland in 10 years. Now, I grew up in the era of Ronald Reagan, John Paul II. I found this to be impossible to believe. But then I started talking to older Catholic priests who said, yes, it's true. The smartphone is the source of most of this. I talked to a Briton who teaches in a Polish high school, and the British man told me, he goes, in this country, there is not one institution, not the church, not the family, not the state, no institution has more power over influencing the way young people think than TikTok and YouTube.
Yeah.
So and Instagram. And this is something that nobody has an answer for. So I want to back up what you were saying on that, and we could be, everybody in this room could live to see the collapse of Poland as a Christian fortress within the next decade or two. I hope it doesn't happen, but if it happens, a lot of it is going to have to do with the smartphone. Now, the question I have is based on Philip Reeve from his book from 1966, The Triumph of the Therapeutic. I've been haunted and puzzled by something Reeve said in the book. He was not a religious believer, but he was an acute cultural analyst. Reif said that sexual renunciation has always been near the center of the Christian social matrix. It wasn't simply saying no, but it was rechanneling that erotic energy to socially positive ends. Reif said that even though modern pastors try to get away from this, it is there. And you can't take it away without the whole thing falling down. But as I recall, Reif didn't explain what he meant by that. Do you have any idea what he means by that? And because I think we can see this in our world today, whenever a church compromises on sexual morality, homo or hetero, it usually collapses. You know, people walk away from it. Can you explain this?
Yeah, well, I think Reif, in general, he's making a sort of Freudian point there, that sexual energy has to be, when it's repressed, has to be redirected somewhere. Freud would have said art, sport, things like that. Reif is, I think, giving a religious spin on that. I was very struck by that and disturbed by that as well, because Reif is essential, and you get this in Freud as well. If sexual repression lies at the foundation of civilization, then what happens to civilization when all rules are lifted? When technology allows us to think that we can lift all rules on that front? And Freud would say civilization ceases. It just collapses at that point. And I think when you think about that, I think in general that point seems to hold strong. Then when you bring it to the church, you know, I doubt that Reif is an acute enough theologian to think about it, but when you think that the analogy between Christ and the church is that between a husband and a wife and the act of marital union, that would seem to indicate that sex and sexual codes are extremely important. When you go to Paul's teaching in Corinthians, where he's hammering the Corinthians for tolerating sexual immorality, and seems to say there, this is even dead, you know, this isn't just your typical deadly sin, it's particularly deadly when a man sins against his own body in this sexual way. Then I think he's pointing to the same thing. Why that is, I don't know, but it seems to me to make perfect sense. I mean, you can certainly understand why societies have historically had fairly strict views of sexual relations, because it's a way of making sure that you can organize families, you can organize societies, etc., etc. Why churches that shift on this collapse? You know, it's interesting that a church can, you think of the history of liberal churches in the United States and England, and churches can allow people to deny the resurrection and still seem to trundle on. But when sexuality is abandoned, sexual mores are abandoned, they seem to fly apart fairly quickly. And I don't know why that would be the case, other than the fact that sex is not a recreation. I mean, I was teaching this in class the other day, the students saying to me, we're taught that sex is a recreation, right? Yep, they all nod their heads, and I say, so if I stick my finger in your ear, well, I actually use, what's his name, the Harvey Weinstein. I said, if Harvey Weinstein had been insisting on sticking his finger into these girls' ears in order for them to get parts in his movies, you'd have thought he was a thoroughly obnoxious human being. But you probably wouldn't think that he needs to go to prison for 25 years. But when he sexually penetrates these girls, we're intuitively horrified by it. Well, why? If sex is just a recreation, why is one form of penetration intrinsically worse than another? But we know it is. I say, you know, you could punch me in the face and I'd get over it. If you sexually assault me, it's likely to mark my life forever. Sexual acts have a powerful cachet. And that would lead me to believe then that rules about sexual acts are extremely important, both for the organization of society and, I suspect, for that and for theological reasons, for the church as well. And that's why internet pornography is such a... there are so many things that could kill us fairly quickly. And internet porn is right at the top of the list as far as I'm concerned.
Carl, thank you so much. That was a fantastic conversation.